Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. And I'm now here with Survive the Jive. Tom, God, is it Rousel or Roussel?
It's Rousel. Yeah.
Rousel, that's what I thought, right?
Yeah, it's a racist microaggression to mispronounce my name, and I will.
Oh, that's my first of the evening. I don't make a point of making them, but anyway. Okay, so welcome back. You weren't on last year, but you were on 2019, and so it's been a wee while. A lot has obviously happened in the world in that time, these last 2 years, but you've said that you don't want to really talk about that because other people will talk about it and certainly will all over mm-hmm. Millennial. So, but instead, we're going to talk about, well, we'll take viewer questions for a start, for certain. That's on Entropy, Cointree, and Odyssey. And you know, I think people usually have a lot of questions for you, so that should be fine. And we're going to start by talking about the Anglo-Saxons, because you were recently at the Traditional Britain Group's Christmas social. Tom and I bumped into each other there. We had a good time. And you gave a speech. So would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, I had a great time. I love the Traditional Britain Group. I think it's so great that it exists. And I said that I started going to their conferences and dinners, must have been about 8 years ago, and seen some, you know, people like Sir Roger Scruton, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and others. And it's just a nice sort of cozy kind of club and celebrating some of the good things about Britain. I was a younger man in my 20s, and I thought, you know, Britain was in a dire state, but God, I didn't think it could get so much worse, but it did. But it was very a great honor that they asked me to go and speak. And being that I have studied Anglo-Saxons, I thought that would be a sort of relevant topic, but I needed to explain in what way Anglo-Saxons were relevant to a traditional Britain group and or to British people. And and I did that by talking about the ways in which Anglo-Saxons have been invoked in different points in history. Pretty much, I went through pretty much every subsequent century since the Norman Conquest to describe how the Anglo-Saxons were invoked in that century and used as part of the constructed identity of Englishness and by extension Britishness from the early modern era and onwards. And I do say identity is constructed. That is absolutely true when the left say that. But that doesn't make it inauthentic in any sense. It's just that's how things are made. They have to be built. But I thought it was very interesting to go through that because I actually disagree a lot with some of the ways in which Anglo-Saxons have been invoked. And the reasons behind their invocation and the way that they were integrated into identity and the things they were used to justify in throughout history. A lot of them I disagree with. And I just find it funny that the left recently, and I've talked about this already in streams and stuff, have tried to ban Anglo-Saxon and say that it's like this, it's got these deep ties to racist ideas. And that's quite a tenuous claim. I think there are probably some like examples that they could use to justify that. But overall, Anglo-Saxon has been really a thing, an identity invoked for like quite liberal, progressive tendencies in the British Isles. So I just thought that was quite amusing. But I think the talk was quite well received and I had a good evening. And it was good to see you there. We caught up a bit. And I still we had quite a late night, so I hope you weren't too tired for the first day. But I watched the first day of Millennial. I watched I watched the ones with a couple of the first ones, the Golden One and Philosophy Cat. So and you did well. So looks like you weren't too tired.
Well, I did. I can't remember what time I tried to go to sleep. I went to bed, but I didn't get to sleep. I only had about 3 hours sleep. That night, so or that day, so it was a very turbulent start to Millennial last night. But, you know, I'll get into a routine inevitably, so it's fine. It doesn't matter. But about the speech, first of all, is it going to go up anywhere online so that people can listen to it?
It probably will. It probably will. Wait, what's your space?
All right. Okay, good. I mean, I really enjoyed it. And I think it would be a shame if it didn't, get a good a wider audience. But it was a nice comprehensive, because I was expecting that it would be, because when I spoke at the TBG 3 years ago, and I think they asked me to speak for like 20 to 25 minutes. They wanted it to be quite brief. So I did that. And I actually quite like that. You know, there are different speeches, and sometimes they ask you to speak for like an hour, rarely. And that's fun, because then you've got a huge epic sort of canvas to work with. But then sometimes, as in, well, the conference where we first met, Stockholm 2017, they asked us to speak for 15 minutes. And I really enjoyed that. Enjoyed it. I thought it was a nice challenge. It was like the equivalent of telling a short story or making a short film. As it's you've got to pack a lot into that 15 minutes. I really enjoyed
that. It forces you to be employ your best rhetoric and oratory,
and to keep it simple, keep it concise, and I really enjoyed that challenge. And so with the TBG, it was like 20, 25 minutes. And so I was expecting, when you started speaking, I thought it was going to be the same, but actually it was about 40, 50 minutes. It was different, and it was a much more, but it needed to be, because it was, as I say, a comprehensive overview of, you know, the life of this phenomenon of, or this concept of Anglo-Saxon. What would you say to someone like just off the cuff right now, what does that term refer to? Let's start at the start. Is it the start, the Brythonics? Is that the start, or would it be the Beaker people? What would be the start here?
I've got my bell beaker here. I'm representing my ancestors. Cheers. Good Yule. Well, the Brythonics are the people of Britain today are a combination of very broadly speaking, two different Germanic invasions and two different broad linguistic groups of Celtic speakers. Although genetically you can divide them into different groups to linguistic groups, but the linguistic groups are Celtic within the British Isles are Gaelic and Brythonic, and the Brythonic speakers included, today we only have Cornish and Welsh, but it included back in the day the language spoken, all languages, probably dialects and languages spoken across England, including Cumbric, which also was spoken up in northwestern Scotland, up as far as Glasgow, and also in the rest of Scotland, except for the Gaelic parts where the Scotty invaded, the Pictish, also the Picts were a Brythonic people who spoke a Brythonic language as well, which would have been more closely related to Welsh than to Irish. Yes, we do descend from them, and we do descend from Germanic peoples, but it's it varies regionally how much people have from each of these different peoples.
And the
bell beaker, just to quickly say, is something, it's not a separate people like that annoying Cambridge educated comedian Stuart Lee and his much loved sketch by blue ticks on Twitter, like to post his sketch about Paul Nuttall, I think it was, from UKIP, talking about, the Beaker folk came and then the Celts came. I was trying to say all these people are different peoples.
Britain obviously is a nation of immigrants, isn't it?
Well, the problem is it ignores chronology. It's like saying, to make it quite simple, the Bell Beakers came thousands of years before the Anglo-Saxons. The Celtic languages arrived, well over a thousand years later from the Bell Beakers. And the overall they're not really different people in a racial or genetic sense. So the Belbeekers are, we're still the Belbeeker people in a sense, although there have been other migrations into the island since the Belbeeker people made a massive population replacement about 4,500 years ago in Britain. And that replaced almost all the people who had lived here before, but not all. And then sometime at the end of the, this is the latest evidence is about to be published by Harvard about it, but it's what a lot of scholars have said before. The Celtic languages would have arrived with the Celtic, when we see in the archaeological record, all the Celtic art starts turning up, which is just at the end of the Bronze Age, early Iron Age. So you're maybe like 1000 BC. So yeah, that's when also now the genetic has shown that there is another genetic change in Britain, but unlike the one when the Belbeeker one, 2400 BC roughly, which replaced about 90% of the population of the entire island, the one that happened at about 1000 BC only maybe replaced, the exact figures are going to be published soon, but it's about 30%, and not in the entire island, mostly just in the southeast of what's now England. And that replacement is or integration, like, because a mixing of the people probably constituted a new elite, because otherwise there wouldn't have been a linguistic change and a material culture change, the Celtic culture that the Belbeeker people adopted. And they were not genetically from the Celtic heartlands of, you know, Hallstatt area, like Austria and Switzerland, and like the northern side of the Alps, basically in Central Europe, is like where the Celtic heartland is. These people weren't from there, the people who brought Celtic to Britain. Unfortunately, I'm ashamed to say they were from France, and they brought, we have to accept that it was the French who brought Celtic to Britain. I'm only joking for those people who don't understand British humor. It's a long-standing thing to joke about our relationships with the French. But when we talk about the Anglo-Saxon Anglo-Saxons coming and their impact genetically, Anglo-Saxons coming around in the migration era after the fall of Rome.
And they're a set of Germanic tribes.
Yeah, they're a confederation almost, but officially they don't have any proper, confederation until quite a long time after they arrive. But they do come in an seemingly organized, like a well-orchestrated movement, which is yet to be fully explained. But there were, we know for a fact from genetic and other sources, archaeological sources, there were Germanic people in Britain under Romans, many of the Roman legionaries, for example. And they may have like had this idea of like going back and like going to Holland, Denmark, Germany, and saying to all these different Germanic tribes, let's all just pile on in because it's a free-for-all right now. And they remember, you know, some of their big shots probably served in the Roman army in Britain and were like, oh, talk about what opportunities, good farmland there. And then they all piled in. But when we talk about, when we say how much Celtic and how much Anglo-Saxon, people talk about, you know, if we're 40% Anglo-Saxon, which is the rough estimation of how much the average person has, then we're 60% Celtic. But that the problem with that is actually what they're saying is 60% pre-Anglo-Saxon, not 60% Celtic. So, as I said, the people who brought Celtic languages to Britain weren't actually the original Celts. So we probably don't have any actual Celtic DNA from the original Celts. But we have maybe in the southeast, we have like about 30% from these French Celts who, you know, maybe they had some DNA from the original Celts from Central Europe too. But they, these Gaulish people brought it in, and then like if the Iron Age Britons, Brythonic people were 30% French and the rest like 70% British Belbeeker, then that's what we mean when we say Celtic, which is confusing because the term Celtic is used fast and loose. People use it all kinds of ways to mean all kinds of things. And whereas when I say 40% Anglo-Saxon, everyone knows what I mean. They're talking about how much DNA came from the Germanic-speaking invaders in the migration era. But when you say how much Celtic DNA, they don't mean how much DNA came from the Celtic invaders, which is stupid because then you're not applying the same criteria for estimating the same thing. So it doesn't make sense. But if you use the term brythonic, then it's much, much better. So the we have about 60% brythonic DNA. But yeah.
It's weird that Anglo-Saxon has become the dominant term then to refer to, you know, the English instead of brythonic. I mean, genetically brythonic.
Well, nobody knew about genetics until recent. The genetic stuff is brand new. So,
but yeah,
there were times when people wanted to dispense with Anglo-Saxon. One was after the Norman conquest, where they really focused on Celtic heritage more, like King Arthur's court that was really popular in court romance, you know, like the court culture of the High Middle Ages in Britain and in France and Wales, and Wales is in Britain, but France as well, like, and the continent, even Germany, everyone loved Arthurian romance. It was like the Marvel comics of its day or whatever, cape shit of its day. But
Harry Potter of its day? Surely not.
Maybe, I don't know if I'm insulting Mallory or whatever, but that was partly because the Normans wanted to have this like long-standing feeling of like connection to the land that they were the rulers of, and by integrating it with France and like the Celts and like, you know, we're all together and just pretend that Anglo-Saxon thing of like those hundreds of years and the fact that the people themselves all speak English and are called English, just ignore that and just pretend that like, okay, we have this Celtic connection. And then that sort of died down again hundreds of years, and then it came back again, something of a necessity but when the union happened, there were there was not like English people weren't rushing to call themselves Celts, but there was a kind of, when Wales and England were unified, there was like the Society of Cymmeridion and things, where like the Society of Ancient Britons, where like in the 18th century, like there were like Welsh people in England, like, you know, calling themselves Society of Ancient Britons and celebrating their Celtic ancestry, but also being pro Britain. They wanted to be part of and unified with England at the same time. I think like maybe a bit later on, there was some in the 19th century when there was a kind of Celtic craze in the romanticist kind of thing. And a lot of people then kind of wanted more to be Celtic, and that kind of survived even to modern times. And some people like Francis Pryor, I think he's very keen on that, and they would like to see themselves as Celts. But like I said, what makes a person a Celt? Like, is it they speak a Celtic language? Because we don't speak Celtic languages. Or is it descent from the people who first spoke Celtic languages? Well, we don't really have any of that either. So is it just that we descend from people who used to speak Celtic languages? Well, that doesn't make any sense as a criteria to determine if someone's something, because, you know, that's quite arbitrary as a thing. But we're not Celtic. And what we are genetically, and I said this in the speech, is to say we're 40% Anglo-Saxon is accurate if you're talking about how much DNA do we have from the people who were coming in on boats at the beginning in the migration era, who didn't call themselves Anglo-Saxons. They called themselves according to their various tribal factions. By the time the term Anglo-Saxon was actually in use, by the time England was a unified nation, the Anglo-Saxons had already integrated with the natives, so they were the same as modern people in Britain. So how much DNA do we have from people who first called themselves Anglo-Saxons? All of it is the answer. So we're 100% Anglo-Saxon in that sense. Like, if you want, I mean, there might be a little bit of integration of, you know, DNA. And obviously some people in the cities are not 100% Anglo-Saxon. But what I'm talking about is
maybe Afro-Saxon. Yeah.
Yes.
But did you hear that there was I think it was a mayor or something, a black guy who called himself Afro-Saxon. I thought that was actually very funny.
They're the real Anglo-Saxons, you know, the real ones.
The original ones, yeah.
the real ones.
But yeah, this obviously is something that is very, very complicated, very and arbitrary. The distinctions in the end are it's quite subjective where you draw lines and so on. So I think it's I'm certainly not agreeing with the left, because the left will say something is socially constructed. It's subjectively decided upon. It's arbitrary. Therefore, it's fake, artificial, meaningless, and we can just dispose of it.
Yes.
There is obviously and then maybe some hardcore right winger would say, no, it's not arbitrary. No, it's not meaningless. No, it's not socially constructed. It's like really stereotypical, there's obviously a middle ground where these things emerged. There is objective truth about them, but there's also so much complexity and mystery that we have to make subjective judgments. And so it is a social construct, but that doesn't mean that it's meaningless or fake or that we can or should dispose of it.
No, as I said earlier, identity is always constructed. And the left knows that. They don't mind identities at all. And in fact, the people like Jordan Peterson and whatever always complaining about how the left plays with identity politics. They encourage identities, and they find it offensive when people's ethnic identities are undermined. And that's, I think, in some cases, that's quite justified. Except when it's at the expense of ours, then of course it's not justified. But they're one sided often with heritage and ancestry is part of identity, and they can pretend, play word games with it when indigenous European peoples, ethnic groups, invoke their ancestry as a part of their identity, word games or thought games or trying to obfuscate and say obviously dishonest things what is this? And what if you have this ancestry as well? Does it stop? At what percentage does it stop being? Well, it's the same thing could be asked of all the protected ethnic groups that they defend. The same questions could be used to undermine their ethnic identities, but they don't do that. It's not my business how much Indian blood an Indian man has to have before he ceases to be an Indian or whatever.
India itself, though, as we were discussing the other night, India is a mix of different ingredients.
I mean, when the left say everyone's a mix, they're right, but it's a truism. It obscures the fact, every drink is a mix. Every drink has different things in it. That doesn't mean that whether I give you a glass of water or a glass of poison is the same thing, because they're both a mix. That's completely asinine thing to say.
Oh, God, yeah. And then the whole thing about, because there are different ingredients, because it's multiple ingredients, therefore there is no totality, because actually it's this and this and this. The left, but also other just pedants, have all sorts of ways of missing the point. This is something I noticed a long time ago, that one of the most frustrating things in debate is when you know that the other person knows what you mean, but they're pretending not to. It's infuriating.
Technique.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Morgoth gave it that name. It.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great name. I've seen it. I've heard it many times. Yeah, it's very frustrating.
Yeah, I won't name names, but there are people who have done that, and you know that they're just pissing around. They're just wasting time. I don't know. It's something that just really offends me. I can never believe people who are happy to just waste time. And insult you by wasting your time.
They're not serious about their lives. They're not serious about who they are. I'm serious about everything I do. I take very seriously, because I believe that life is serious. I believe in I believe in the gods. I believe in the universe and everything in it has meaning, and that everything you do is very important. And what your existence has significance. So when if you're going to argue for something, you should take it very seriously, and you shouldn't be dishonest. You shouldn't play around with arguments you don't even believe in, just for, people like to repeat arguments they've heard on television. They thought sounded convincing, but then when they try them out and it's demonstrated in argument that it's facile, they stick to it or just pretend they don't understand because they're not really interested in actually exploring ideas, which is the real function of a proper argument.
And of course, for young people, and whenever I always envisage some like 18, 20-year-old girl who's heard this thing from her lecturer or she's heard it on TV and she's going to repeat it, thinking that, and this happened a lot on YouTube back in the day, you'd get some, and often men as well, often young men as well, but the stereotype is, it seems best manifested in the female version, like a young woman who just says what she repeats what she's heard elsewhere, thinking, well, that's that. I've mm-hmm. done it. I've won. And really, it's just, as you said, facile. A lot of these things that you hear on TV. I mean, I think the last time you were on, we talked about Cheddar Man. And there are still people, now 2 years later, there are still people who've heard this on TV. Well, the original British people had dark skin. So therefore, we're all from Africa, and therefore unlimited migration from Africa today is not only a good idea, but it's not even something to remark upon. Yeah. It's just a continuation of the situation that we've had for the last 5-10,000 years, when of course that's utterly ridiculous, and they must know even while they say it that that's ridiculous.
No, they don't know, actually. I think there are of course a lot of people who just aren't capable of thinking about things properly, and it's kind of like you're geared up, like there's to make arguments to justify the things that you're already part of your life and integrated into the way you do things. So if you're literally like gonna lose your job and everyone that you know in your life will turn around and hate you if you make this decision, then it's not like you're approaching an argument with an unbiased view of two positions. You're gonna end up like finding ways to try and like justify a position that you that would be advantageous to you, and that's what they do. And if they want to say that immigration is good, and they saw on television Cheddar Man was black, they don't say dark skin, they say he was black, which is obviously a legal category which used by the police. You don't call, if you see a Tamil person who has dark skin, you don't say he's black, you say he's Indian or Asian, they say, which is another funny term, but they mean sub-Saharan African. And he wasn't sub-Saharan African. There's never any evidence to show that or anything that he was even promoted. In fact, I'm more related to sub-Saharan Africans than Cheddar Man. I'm pretty fly for a white guy. But they never...
Are you Edam Man or Gouda Man? Or
I'm Squeezy Cheesy Man. But I never would bother trying to argue that with someone like that, because they haven't reached that conclusion because they've looked at the evidence. They're thinking that because they know it's the safe thing to do, to own the opposition that you're allowed to own. You're allowed to argue against these people and be in the moral right. You've been given the authorization by your superiors to do that, and you can do it quite safely without worrying about anything bad happening to you. That's why they do that. So it's not really worth it, because they're not sort of capable of actual proper real, like intellectual thought or engaging with ideas or anything like that. So it's a waste of breath and time. But I mean, for those people, what's effective is another kind of communication strategy, really, which is rhetorical and doesn't involve argument. I think it's more like other things hopefully I create some of that sort of thing myself, but I'm sure lots of people do. But I mean, Cheddar Man itself isn't what that whole Cheddar Man debacle wasn't presented as an argument. It was presented as an image. And that was why it was powerful.
Do you mean the image of his, the reconstruction of his head?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
It was
very powerful.
And perhaps that was deliberate. Didn't you say was it in the speech or was it afterwards that you were saying that the guy in charge of it had a certain bias?
That was afterwards. It wasn't in the speech. I didn't mention Cheddar Man in the speech.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That. Yeah,
No, well, he published Tom Booth, who worked for the Natural History Museum, among other things. He's an archaeogeneticist. He worked in archaeogenetics, and he had published in the previous year, I think it was 2017, a paper, a collaborative paper. I can't remember who the other author was. I think it was through UCL, through my old uni, in which he argued that Brexit had happened, and it was, he didn't say why that was bad. It was just assumed because Brexit happened, Brexit bad. And this may have been fed into by the way the media reports on historical peoples in the British Isles as having a kind of continuity with the existing the indigenous people. And he was saying this kind of narrative creates a sense of us and them and like a division, and what needs to happen in future, speaking from 2017, is an effort to disrupt this sense of an exclusive connection to these ancestors by like the white people in England, basically. So he said that openly. It's published, you can go and see it. And then the following year, he's involved in, he doesn't make the reconstruction, but he was behind the paper. And to be fair, I don't dispute that the likelihood Cheddar Man had dark skin. People have often said that, like, I've got angry and said that he didn't have dark skin. I've never, ever said that Cheddar Man didn't have dark skin, ever. In fact, I was the first person to go on the, I was in 2017, in April 2017, long before the Cheddar Man thing, I was saying that Mesolithic Europeans, Western Europeans had dark skin. So I was saying this already. So it's not like, it's complete opposite of the truth to say that I was opposing it. What I was opposing was the fact that Tom Booth's team said it was dark, and they had a prediction calculator which made it much darker than any other lab in Europe had ever said that the complexion was. And it was disputed by some of the most prominent geneticists in the world, who said they thought that Tom Booth's team had gone too far onto the dark side of how dark he was likely to be. Although it's a prediction calculator, they don't know really anyway. And even Booth would admit that. But then afterwards, when they took it to the artist, who's not a scientist, they said to him, go with the darkest possible. And then when the photographers took photos of the reconstruction, they sort of like tweaked it to make it even darker. So apparently the actual statue isn't as dark as the media photos. So you can see it's like a Chinese whispers of making it darker and darker until you get this image of very, you know, dark skin.
It's absurd. It's like you could end up with just a black square for the photo.
Yeah, it's like the placeholder image when you start a new profile. That's what I disputed, and I thought, and obviously they didn't complain about that, even though they knew that that was wrong. And they did complain. Several scientists complained directly to me on Twitter in 2018 when I was complaining, but they didn't complain about all the thousands of black people who were saying Cheddar Man is black, even though they know that that was completely untrue. That's like so far from the genetic truth that it's more accurate to say Boris Johnson is black. It's scientifically more accurate to say Boris Johnson is black than it is to say Cheddar Man is black in that sense. And when Afua Hirsch said, you know, like the first people in Britain were Africans and we blacks were here first, she was saying that. She got a contract with the National Geographic that same time. And she argued with me on Twitter, and I said to her, like, you're wrong, you've made a mistake, you need to retract that statement. She's like, no, I didn't make a mistake. All of these people who were attacking me, like little old me, getting all this attention from Adam Rutherford or whatever, and Tom Booth about it, but they didn't worry about Afua Hirsch saying that, because obviously, even if I had made an error, it would be minor comparison to anything Afua Hirsch said. But they don't mind that Afua Hirsch has a platform in the National Geographic where she's spreading completely scientifically inaccurate things. Why don't they care? Why don't they, as scientists, care about the dissemination of misinformation in that case? Because they have a political agenda. And in that case, her misinformation fit their agenda. And my true information didn't. So they don't care about truth. That they've demonstrated that absolutely. And these are people like You know, the BBC get Adam Rutherford out all the time, wheel him out as the go-to geneticist because he's bought, paid for, controlled, says what he's supposed to say, and will never ruffle any feathers or anything like that. But, you know, people have seen through him.
I mean, there is a cliche that scientists are not, you know, uber rational, logical, objective, that there is always bias, but it does seem quite incredible that there could be this level of bias, especially now, because for the last 100 years, we've sort of, well, more than that, but it's, you know, when you and I were growing up, I think that there was a general sort of feeling, general sense that nowadays we've worked out how to be objective. We have a lot of stuff is computerized now, like data analysis is automated. So human bias would be impossible there. But even when it comes to human judgment, we are very diligent. There's you know, probability about honesty and integrity, objectivity, and so on. And that's borne out by the success of modern medicine, obviously current affairs notwithstanding, and science, just scientific advance. So you would think, okay, yeah, we must be getting really good at being objective and clear and thorough. But really, well, what would you say about that? Because on the one hand, you told me that genetic research is really good nowadays, over the last 10 years. But clearly, yeah, there's also a highly, but clearly, there's also a highly political or politicized faction within the scientific community who are looking for ways to advance narratives, not truth.
Yeah, there are, but I don't think. I mean, I'm not a scientist. In case anyone, and you know that, but in case anyone who is not familiar with who I am, because I'm a historian, documentary maker. Not a scientist, but I'm very interested in science. I have worked as a science communicator for the World Health Organization. The problem isn't necessarily always with the scientists, although many scientists may indeed have political biases. That every people are biased. That's natural. I don't think we're going to reach a stage where humans don't have bias, and I'm not worried about scientists, individual scientists having political biases. They are. It's more difficult for a scientist to insert his political bias into his work than it is for someone in the humanities, where it's done routinely and pretty much all the time. But the way science is communicated to the general public, science communications is heavily politicized, really, really politicized and controlled. And as it's part of this cult of scientism, which is the desired way that non-scientifically informed, you know, normal people are supposed to regard science, which is with deep reverence, like a kind of like a cultic reverence, without yes. really understanding anything, and that's been very much encouraged by the media, and this is very political. I think that's the core of the problem, rather than anything wrong with scientists. Like Tom Booth has a liberal bias; he's a scientist, but he's not lying in his work. I don't think he published any deliberately inserted false data into any of his work. I'm not accusing him of that kind of malpractice. I mean, he's openly talked about his, you know, he's not trying to hide the fact with that Brexit article that he obviously thinks, but that article was talking about science communications. So he was talking about recommendations for how science should be communicated in the media. So I don't think that, I don't think Tom Booth's a bad scientist or anything. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying his bias as a liberal, and that he is happier when he saw his work communicated in a distorting way that reinforced, his political assumptions that he has. But and the same is true with people like Adam Rutherford. But he's really, you know, a media figure for talking about science. So I'm kind of. I've become something of a alternative science communicator as unintentionally, but the same thing can be said. I don't want to go too deep into it, but the science on the COVID virus and on the effects of the different mRNA vaccines isn't actually very bad. If a lot of the people who are critical of the way that the media and the government have tackled these issues post peer-reviewed scientific papers as a way to oppose them. And they do that because the papers show the data. So that the papers, the scientists are still studying and showing what's right, and those papers are still being published by reputable scientific journals. So there isn't, the problem isn't so much the scientists and as such, it's the media and governments and things like that that are really using science and exploiting the naturally, you know, lack of awareness that people have of quite technical things to distort the findings. And
I wouldn't want to comment on that, but what I would say is I would be surprised if scientists, that if their funding did not influence their activity. You know,
of course, when it comes to
the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and you know, all this kind of thing. But I'm not speaking that. Yeah, but I wouldn't. I'm not going to, you know, besmirch any particular scientists.
When you do any, regardless of what, if you go into academia, you're going to do a dissertation on something, right? You've got to make sure that it's going to, I mean, if you want to become an academic, you're going to choose a topic that you think will get you attention. So you've got to appeal to the sensibilities of existing academics and to where, or if you need research funding, you've got to appeal to the groups that are providing the funding. So that's like the whole academic structure. When people have sometimes comment, like with this hatchling approach, like, oh, I notice you're sort of implying some kind of woke conspiracy of like left-wing bias in universities. Can you provide any evidence of that?
Like, yeah, and then they'll ask for a peer-reviewed study of that.
Have you got a peer-reviewed study? The entire... You know, the incentivization of every action you take in higher education is always pushing you towards being further and further toward left-wing or globalist views. There's nothing in the pushing in the other direction at all, at least in the West.
Okay. Well, I've got to say that your background has become non-symmetrical.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I was messing with the thing. I better fix that. Very sorry to the
it's been bothering everyone.
Anyone with OCD or autism or anything that would upset them. Is it perfect yet? Okay.
Not quite. Okay. A wee bit more over to your right. Or it's going to bother me. I don't mind, really.
Everything is okay.
But we were talking about that before we went on air. I pointed out how, you know, Kubrickian the background was with the beams, and it just struck me at the time.
Red shirt could be like a flood of blood coming out of a lift, if you like.
Yeah, that's a good image. Okay, there are some questions for you. This is out of left field. Do you ever get flack from Christians? If so, how do you respond?
Never in real life. Every Christian who I meet in real life and I've told is that I'm telling my pagan, they never have any problem with it. I've had good relationships with Catholics I had good contacts with members of different Catholic factions in Britain. In Sweden, I was in touch with members of the Orthodox Church, and I had, you know, lunches, dinners with Orthodox priests, and my wife's family are priests of the Lutheran Church, and I've never had any issue. I've never promoted any kind of conflict with Christians ever, and I've always encouraged civility with Christians. But some people, internet Christians, seem to think like something completely different. It's like it's similar to like it's similar to the idea that some people think that I really hate people from the south of Europe and that I make videos complaining them, or that I or that I said Cheddar Man was had white skin. I never said any of those things. Like, people have these really clear ideas of me hating Christians, hating things. I never said anything. You go through hours of my videos, never said anything of the kind. I never said anything against Christians. I had said against Christianity to explain why I'm not a Christian. I don't believe that Jesus is God. It's very simple. I don't believe that. I don't believe the Bible is a true book. It's that it comes down to that and nothing else. It's not like I have some personal vendetta against Christians. There's nothing of the kind. I've never had any problem with them or any other religion, really. But online people, especially the newly converted people who use their newly adopted religion as a surrogate for or a replacement for a proper identity, they become very sensitive and they see me as a threat.
Well, first of all, I think, yeah, the internet does bring out the worst in people. There's no question of that. I mean, people treat you or anyone in general in a way that they would never treat you in real life. If they were speaking to you man to man, face to face, they'd never do this kind of stuff. So, yeah, that's true. And then as for the zeal of the convert, I think that's absolutely a thing. I mean, that is a cliche for a very good reason. It's because, and you can see it in real time, like now, people who develop a new worldview or adopt a new worldview, and it becomes everything to them. And they're obsessed. And then they've got to chase out the unbelievers, the people who disagree, who reject that worldview. I think
part of it, if I may interject, is because of a crisis of identity in the West. And I don't want to be unfair to Americans, but I do think it was, at least initially, it seemed to be very predominantly an American phenomenon, but nothing that's an American phenomenon ever remains a uniquely American phenomenon for long. Like, it's in the West and other places as well. But there's this kind of thing, like, they see religion as just like every other thing that we're presented in this world. Like, it's a product you buy, or it's a garment you put on, and this is like the first thing you do is adopt like the phony outrage and political opinions of that you know cookie cutter identity you've just put onto yourself. So I'm a Christian now, so I hate pagans or whatever they decided to do. And it's like, instead of first beginning with the fundamentals of what do you believe. What do you actually believe? Because religion is about, or Christianity is very much about belief, at least, if not all religion. But it's everything's backwards.
Yeah, yeah. You said, I mean, also, just on that point, I do think that there's a certain way of being nowadays that has, I think, emerged since World War II. And I think was initially centered in America, but I think is now you can now see it manifesting in Europe, which is a certain lack of ancestral awareness of ancestral identity and being stuck in the here and now, being stuck as a consumer with not even a national much awareness of your national identity. It's just, well, I'm a consumer. I do this stuff. I buy that product. I use that service. Obviously, no one would ever say that. Out loud, but
you might not even think it consciously.
Yeah, exactly. But it's their way of being is dictated really just by the products that they partake of, and I think that you can understand that being a thing in post-war America, especially latterly the 80s, 90s, 2000s. But I think it's now a thing in Europe. I think you see people. I remember when I was in Norway. When was that? 2017.
In the before time.
Yeah. it was a really interesting moment that I've always remembered, and I've talked about it before, where we happened to be there for the Skanza conference on the same day as Gay Pride in Oslo. And so I was watching a bunch of young people walking along with their banner and whatever to this Gay Pride march that was about to start. And I looked at them and I thought that these are young Norwegians, presumably. But I don't actually know whether they're Norwegians. And the thing that unites them is that they're, you know, they're up for gay rights. They're up for gay pride and whatever. They might be gay. They might not. They might probably aren't even gay. They're probably just young liberals, you know. I mean, they were like teenagers or something. I can't really remember now, but they were just a sort of generic modern, not even European, a generic modern white person. And that was obviously, this is just my impression of them from across the street as I watched them walking past. I just thought you could belong to, you could come from any country. There's nothing really.
Making sexuality and identity is a part of it.
And well, or even also, the attitude towards sexuality, because I don't know whether they were gay or bisexual.
Or like, in that case, it becomes an opinion. My opinion is my identity, my opinion on sexuality that I've adopted from the media. But I guess we in Britain, I do like not to be unfair on Americans, because I know they get pissed off with
absolutely and Europeans it's not fair.
Acting like they're always the worst. Yeah. But like,
I'm not saying we had the mods
versus rockers in Britain. Was definitely Americanized stuff, because it was like influenced by American soul music for the mods and American rock and roll for the rockers. But it manifested in a uniquely British way. But it was basically like an excuse for them. Like there was inbuilt native like desires among young men to like let off steam and have some, you know, have a few fights, which has always been around in Britain. But it manifested in a new way where like you put on the clothing of the, you know, the product, you bought the records associated with being a rocker or a mod, and then you had to fight the guy who looked different. And it was complete, the media made a big thing about it, but they hadn't really understood what was happening. But I think it was like, it was the start of that post-war identity crisis thing in our country, where you cease to be simply an Englishman. You have to be instead, or, you know, or even at a greater level, a Londoner or a Yorkshireman. Instead, you have this other kind of subcultural identity, which is really a plethora of products.
Indeed, and it transcends geography as well. We should point that out, that it's not to do with any particular city or any country. It's your attitudes, it's your ideas, and the music you listen to. But what I wanted to ask you earlier, when you said that when people, someone, the cliche of the zealous convert who makes his religion the whole of his identity instead of developing a proper identity. That's an interesting, I don't know if you said it off the cuff, maybe you would want to revise it, but what would you mean by a proper identity? Because I know that this is something that concerns me. When people talk about ethnic or national, and they say, that's my identity, there are people in our movement who will say that. And I think that's not quite healthy, because... Mm. It really,
you can't just be walk around in a beef eater costume, say I am Britain.
And yeah, exactly.
You've got to be like, it's a part of your identity. It informs your identity. Yeah. You can't authentically escape Britishness if you're British. You can't say, oh, that's not part of my identity if you're British. It is part of your identity. And to be have an authentic identity, you have to accept that into it. But like, it's not all who you are. Like, it's not complete. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was wondering whether you would agree with that. I think you would, and how you would verbalize it. Because to me, a proper identity is an amalgamation of things, not least your own personal experiences, which are unique to you, even though other people might well be able to identify with them. But it's your own experiences, your own family, your religion, your nationality, and then... in addition to all of that, any ideas that you might adopt or attitudes or whatever. But it's the amalgamation of all of that. It's not just like I am Britain or I am Christian or I am a pig and that's all there is to it. And I think that people do become there's a danger of people becoming very reliant on one particular thing, and then that's it. That's what they are and that's who they are. That I don't think is healthy. And I think that goes for political labels as well. I worry about that. And I did worry about that for the last few years. I don't want to encourage people to just see themselves as, you know, white or British or Scottish or English. or nationalists or whatever. I want people to have a healthy sense of their own individual identity.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. And I can see why it happens, though, because I feel like I was a bit like that myself when I was young, when I was young, I was, you know, immersed in all the cultural milieu of that everyone else was. And I accepted many of the nonsense that everyone else did before I could start to see through it. But I can even see that people who have the wisdom to, you know, eschew the mainstream media and go for alternative media would still get sucked in, because you, to speak frankly, you and I, as YouTubers, have to present ourselves as a kind of a product. And what I have, and in so doing, we limit streamline it to make it more understandable what it is. Calling yourself Millennial Woes is like, you know, not always sad, are you? You're not just a millennial. You're not always, but it has to be simplified so that it can be digestible.
And then
people who absorb our content if they're young and impressionable, they might think like, oh, if they're just about one thing, then maybe I have to be just about one thing. They don't understand that, of course, there's all kinds of other things about us that we don't include in the online persona or whatever that's projected, because we can't have everything there.
This is something where I'm quite different from most YouTubers and recovering YouTubers, in that I really did just give everything. I just did say everything. There's, you know, something that people always say to me is that when they meet me in real life is that I'm exactly as I am in the videos, which I like. You know, I am very, you know, it's very candid and direct. But that does also come with some risks, which I wasn't quite fully aware of back at the start. But yeah, I know what you mean. That for the vast majority of YouTubers, it's you're presenting, you know, most people have the sense to present a more simplified version of themselves, because that's just how to make something accessible for people. I mean, it's just common sense.
I was trying to make some kind of point about like the way that we engage with media and technology forcing us into this kind of, it pushes us a bit towards this sort of,
it definitely
crisis
does.
Of identity. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely agree.
Even among we who sort of talk about it, notice it and oppose it and try and encourage people to more positive identity, we're still in other senses, like contributing to it unintentionally just because of the nature of the technology that's involved.
I remember seeing similar to what I was saying about that Norway experience. About 2 years ago, I stumbled upon some YouTube channel, and it was some young British guy, English, but you know, that doesn't really matter, because he could have been American, he could have been Australia, it really wouldn't have mattered. He even seemed kind of transatlantic, his way of speaking, that there was a certain slant to his accent, which is, you know, Americanized. And I remember watching him and thinking, he's about 20 years old. And I thought, there's really nothing to you. And I guess that's a bit unfair to say that about a 20-year-old, because of course a 20-year-old is young and, you know.
Still finding out.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking, you're on track to be just a sort of walking consumer product. You know, obviously that is going to be the case with a young person, that they haven't forged their identity very much yet. But I think one of the unhealthy aspects of the modern age, of our age, is that it actively encourages that. It very actively encourages people to identify with their consumer lifestyle. But I would say, though, that I think that COVID in the last 2 years, we're now entering a new era, which might be different in this respect, in that people are, I think, will be encouraged not to identify with their consumer products and their lifestyle as a consumer so much as their duty towards the collective. I think it's a sort of artificial collectivism that's being encouraged. Mm-hmm. So I think, and I might well be completely wrong here, but that's what seems to be happening to my mind. I think that this age of sort of rank consumerism it might be coming to an end. I'm not sure.
Well, I don't. I mean, you think something more like good old fashioned communism might appear. Or
Well, not necessarily that. But what I mean is, when I talk about duty towards the collective, I mean obeying COVID regulations, seeing yourself as a node in a human organism with a duty.
The loss of the individual.
Yeah.
But that's another kind of. It's another flavor of this, like the loss of the individual. Like one of them is where the true individuality, which is quite a, you know, I dare say, or certainly some authors who I respect would call it a rare historical phenomenon that occurred in a certain time, where the individual suddenly becomes significant in history. But whether or not that's true, like certainly I think that the 20th century saw like a kind of, as we discussed, a kind of degradation of the Western individual, where it was, you know, reduced to your purchases and those kind of things. But that other kind is the loss of the individual in the collectivism, which I think is probably more. I don't agree with. I'm not a communist. I don't want to live in a communist dictatorship or anything. But I do think collectivism is preferable in some ways because it requires a sacrifice. At least you're saying, I sacrifice my own, you know, my own, what's beneficial to me as an individual for something else, for a greater cause. Now, the cause is often phony, and the collective is often evil. So that's what I pose. But the actual principle is that it is something more, I think, preferable and to the real, almost, you know, bottomless pit nihilism of like the consumer individuals, like we're all individuals. Yes, we're all individuals, like in Monty Python, you know, that's the kind of vibe.
I know what you mean. As I say, this is just a sort of speculative hypothesis of mine that things are now changing. They might not, and they might reverse as well. Who knows? It might just be a temporary thing with COVID. I'm not sure. But anyway, yeah, we'll move on from that because I've just realized that there are quite a lot of questions that have come in. So we'll just rattle through those. Fife and Drum says, here's a thanks for the streams this Yuletide. Thank you very much. Okay. Survive the Jive, thank you for the great speech you delivered on Saturday. I just wondered if you could elaborate more on the relationship of the Cornish to the rest of the UK, thinking specifically of the Bretons and what you've written about Dark Devon.
I never wrote anything about Dark Devon.
Really?
I've never written anything about it, but I might have. So I think someone might, I think I might know who that asked that question, but anyway, I did actually, because someone asked that same question on the night, and I think I'll ask again. But funnily enough, another speaker at the Traditional Britain Group earlier this year, Sir Walter Bodmer, was involved in a landmark study funded by the Wellcome Trust called The People of the British Isles. And it was well publicized and did show some amazing distinctions between the Cornish and other people, including most of England actually doesn't have county by county differentiated genetic groups, because since the Industrial Revolution, we moved around so much that England, from most of the north all the way to the southeast and most to the southwest, is all sort of one group. But Devon is distinguished because it hasn't been so industrialized. And Cornwall is distinct from Devon. So Cornwall and Devon have a genetic line along the Tamar River. Sir Walter Bodmer would be better to ask about this thing than me, but I know that their genetic groups weren't defined by, they didn't define genetic groupings by ancestral components. But other analysis of Cornish samples that I've seen done by colleagues, not necessarily in published papers, but reliable analysis, has shown that they do have higher rates of, marginally, not significantly, but higher rates of Neolithic farmer DNA than other people in Britain and Ireland. So that's probably because of close ties to Brittany, because the French have less steppe ancestry, more farmer ancestry. So in that sense, yeah, that's what I mean. The Cornish might be distinguished because of their higher level of Neolithic farmer ancestry, but they are also distinguished. Even if that wasn't the true, they would still be distinguished anyway because of the lack of movement of peoples into Cornwall. Historically, there haven't been massive migrations into Cornwall. Like the Industrial Revolution caused people in England to move around a lot, but not into Devon and Cornwall. Some people moved out. The Cousin Jacks, Cornish people will be aware of. The Cousin Jacks were, lots of them moved to Australia when mining was not popular in Cornwall anymore. And they moved to Africa, like South Africa. A lot of Cornish people were mining in Africa, Australia, places like that. But yeah. They are distinct in that sense. I don't know. I want to talk about Dark Devon because I never actually wrote anything about that, and I don't. I'll just skip that part.
What do you know what that refers to? I don't know what that. I've never heard that.
I think it refers to how some people in the southwest of England, who an indigenous British people from the southwest of England, have sometimes a darker complexion, quite noticeably.
Right. Okay.
But that they don't form a separate genetic group within the British Isles, these people. It's just that actually is a greater variation of complexion among indigenous British people than some people realize. The fairest people in the pretty much the world are probably in Northern Ireland, and the northwestern Europe is the fairest part of Europe. But there are some people in Britain, natives in Britain, who are quite dark skinned, but and they are generally from the southwest in Devon and Cornwall. I don't know why that is, but there's an old like folk tale about Spanish sailors at the Armada swimming ashore, but that's bullshit. That's just not true. That's not what it is. It's not elevated levels of Spanish ancestry, because sometimes these people are darker than Spaniards, but it's not. They're not. They don't have like Middle Eastern or some kind of ancestry like that. That's not the explanation. I don't know what it is, but it's quite interesting. I'm sure someone clever will
one day. It's the same. There are also Irish people, native Irish. Obviously, I don't mean modern new Irish. I mean native who are quite dark skinned and dark, like black hair. There's a huge diversity within that landmass of Ireland between the uber pale red hair to one end and that at the other end.
There's quite a lot of diversity within our gene pool.
Now this one I don't really understand what this means. Could you speak to why WHGs may have
that means that, yeah,
what does it
that
mean?
That refers to Mesolithic European Western Europeans, he means. They're called WHGs, yeah.
Right, okay. Could you speak to why they may have had darker skin than SHG and EHGs? What was the evolutionary reason why WHGs didn't develop lighter skin? Bloody hell, that's quite an involved question.
Yes. Sorry, as I said, I'm not a scientist, but I can tell. I do my best. But first of all, the categories for the people who don't know: Eastern hunter gatherers, SH is EHG. SHG means Scandinavian hunter gatherers. WHG means Western hunter gatherers. Western hunter gatherers are all these people lived in the Mesolithic. Eastern hunter gatherers lived in Eastern Europe and up into Siberia, right up that way. That label, a lot of people don't like that label because it covers too many peoples, and Western hunter-gatherers is more well-defined. It's a group of hunter-gatherers living in Western Europe, from Spain, Italy, Britain. And then in parts of the Baltic and Scandinavia, the two mix together, and they call that Scandinavian hunter-gatherers, but it's just a mix of the two. The Scandinavian hunter-gatherers, despite having ancestry from Western hunter-gatherers, are generally lighter-skinned. There's probably going to be a mixture of influences from on the environment, combining like the amount of sunlight they get with what's in their diet. So I would speculate that the WHG were getting, were living in a hotter part of Europe. A lot of them were living in Spain and Italy, whatever. The ones in Britain and Ireland didn't, but so you'd think they'd get lighter skin, but it's possible they didn't need lighter skin if they had very high amounts of shellfish and seafood in their diet. And the shell middens, which are these huge piles of shells accumulating over hundreds of years, where they just chuck them in the same pile for some reason. But that's a phenomenon that happens all over the world. Hunter-gatherers do that for some reason. That indicates they did do that, and there's a wealth of seafood resources. And it's much, much safer, you know, knocking limpets off a rock than it is trying to throw spears at a big, hairy animal. So that's probably, most hunter-gatherers weren't actually, you know, tackling tigers. They were just walking around on the beach picking up crabs and stuff. And you get enough vitamin D doing that, so you don't really need lighter skin if you do that. So that's possibly why. Possibly.
Okay. All right. You previously mentioned that the 13th century Mongols had, now is this Scythian or Scythian?
In like typical, what you're talking about is a Greek word used to describe an Iranic speaking people that was then Latinized, and then when in Britain we changed the pronunciation of Latin, so in British you could say Scythian, but the word should be Scythian.
I say Scythian
because that's what they would, that would be much closer to what the word was, rather than like you don't ever pronounce C as a S in old Latin or old Greek, so it, okay. They don't, that's just not there. So,
okay, yeah. Well, I'll use that pronunciation then. You previously mentioned that the 13th century Mongols had Scythian admixture. Do present day Mongols have Scythian admixture?
Yes.
Can you give us an ethnic breakdown of present day Mongols?
No.
Is that too complicated?
Oh, I don't have it. It can be done, but I don't have it to hand, and I'm not going to try and find it now. So sorry, but no. But yeah, they got some Scythian DNA. I can't remember how much, but they have some.
Okay. Sergei Shoigu talks about cloning a Scythian. Would you support such an endeavor?
I don't understand what for there, but they weren't some kind of like super race of people. They're just some like yogurt eating horse guys.
I don't know what this refers to, but I'm guessing it's like, you know, with, they were talking about cloning a woolly mammoth about 5 years ago. I never heard any more about that, whether it worked.
That's quite a cool idea. I mean, I have mixed feelings about cloning and stuff. On the one hand, I think, yeah, it'd be quite cool to clone some ancient animal and let them loose and see what happens. But I'm generally very wary of this sort of thing, because in this current climate, it seems that some very worrying developments in genetic modification. I don't like genetic modification in general. I don't. I'm interested in genetics. I think that a lot of medical breakthroughs can be made with genetics. Like pharmacogenetics is going to be the future, where you'll be able to make sure that you don't take medicines that give you adverse reactions, because you'll be able to tell if that medicine is going to react with your individual genetic, you know, sensibility. So you won't have to try and find out. Things like that is great, but the idea of like the Dolly the sheep and the Frankenstein food stuff back in the 90s was sort of like, a lot of people in Britain were against that stuff, and now things have just sort of, people, that kind of anti sentiment is not strong as it used to be, and I think people have been conditioned to now be a little bit more passive about it. But I think they should be on their guard, because it does pose all kinds of threats. Some we could predict, and maybe many we can't. We're sort of opening up a box of worms there. So I don't want them to make a Scythian, you know, Jurassic Park or something, Scythian Park.
That idea did occur to me. all right. And then here's another one. What are your thoughts on the Khazarian hypothesis for the origin of the Ashkenazi? I can't find any evidence to support this hypothesis.
It was a hypothesis that was based on sound history, and it was not an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory or anything, and it wasn't pseudoscience. It was an honest and quite reasonable attempt to explain the origin of the Ashkenazim, but it is wrong, and it's been shown to be wrong in the broader sense that it doesn't explain the origins of the Ashkenazim by itself. There is a possibility Ashkenazim do have some descent from converting Khazarians, but they're not genetically similar at all. So it's not a significant portion of their DNA. And in fact, even if they do, from what I gather, the only some of the Ashkenazim could even possibly have some Khazarian DNA, and it would only be a small amount anyway. So we don't need the Khazars to explain the origin of the Ashkenazim anyway. And also the Khazars don't explain the origin of the Ashkenazim. Should I explain any of this to people, do you think, Woz, in case they want other people who don't know the subject should?
Yes.
Or is it too boring?
If you think it would be advantageous, yeah, go ahead.
Well, basically, the Khazar theory is like the Khazars were a bunch of steppe nomads related to the Scythians, but they didn't speak Iranic. They spoke a Turkic language. They lived in Ukraine and parts of Eastern Europe on the steppe, and they lived that steppe lifestyle, horsemen, you know. Some of them decided it was a good idea to convert to other religions because they used to be like, you know, Tengrists or whatever, worshipping shamanic religion. Some of them decided to convert to other religions, and some of them, elites of, among them at least, has converted to Judaism as their choice religion. And the Ashkenazim are the European Jews of Eastern Europe, who known a lot, most people will know who I'm talking about. Most, if you know someone who's Jewish in the West, they're probably Ashkenazi, and their origin was mysterious until recently, but genetic studies now show that we know that they sort of differentiate from other Jews due to a bottleneck in the medieval times. I think it's about 800 or 1,000 years ago, and only 800 to 1,000 people. One of the numbers is 800, one of them is 1,000. I can't remember which. But so
that's
a very small amount of people.
An evolutionary bottleneck.
An evolutionary bottleneck, but it wasn't evolution that made the bottleneck. It was something else. But for some reason, a bunch of them separated. And then, a bunch of them first took native European wives, or like mixed with Europeans, women, probably from, or definitely from south of Europe, maybe Greece, maybe Italy, maybe from Anatolia, but that hasn't been explored properly. And then they've been Roman Jews, basically, living in the Roman Empire. And then in the, well after the fall of the Roman Empire, in the medieval era, they moved into the Holy Roman Empire, into Germany, hence the name Ashkenazim, because it comes from a Jewish belief of a giant called Ashkenaz, who they believe was the progenitor of the German people. So Ashkenazi Jew just means German Jew. So in Jewish law. So then they left Germany and moved out into Eastern Europe mostly. And then much later in history, they came back into Germany and parts of Western Europe. But they speak a Germanic language called Yiddish. But yeah, they don't have significant amounts of DNA from Khazars. So the theory is it might have a little bit of truth, because there might be some gene flow from Khazars into them, but that's not what they are. They're not Khazars. It's not a significant part of their DNA. And it's just not worth clinging to. Like some people who want to dis... Some Muslims like it because they can say, oh, the Israelis don't belong. They're not really Jews. They don't belong in the Middle East or whatever. And some Christians like it because they can say the real, they're not the real Jews or whatever. But whatever reason people like it, it's not true. So probably not worth thinking about it.
All right. Are this, and I, another word I don't know how to pronounce, are the Sumerian like the Scythians? And why did Robert E. Howard seek inspiration from them for Conan?
No, they're not. They're completely unrelated peoples. And why did Robert E. Howard do that? I don't know. But Robert E. Howard just liked to mix and match all kinds of things. Conan was a Cimmerian, which is a sort of, they're related to. Oh, did you say Sumerians or Cimmerians?
C-I-M-M.
Oh, sorry. I thought you said Sumerian. Oh, no. Yes, they are. Oh. Yeah. They are related to Scythians. Yeah. They were similar people. Yeah. And why did he seek? Because they were barbarian, like cords, just, you know, the Cimmerians were barbarians. The Scythians were barbarians. And he liked that because it's epic and cool. I fully endorse the novels of Robert E. Howard. They're really fun and good reads, good pulp fiction. I can't say any more than that.
Are they what is best in pulp fiction?
Yes.
Sorry. All right. What was the other? There was one more. Ah, yes. Are variations in skin tone among Northwestern Europeans a consequence of natural selection or sexual selection?
If your variations would be the result of mutation, the prevalence of a mutation could be the result of selection. If you say if one, you know what I mean, like the existence of it is not necessarily, I don't know. I mean the pale skin, the fair skin, Northwest Europeans in general, specifically a complexion, then we can talk about what resulted in that trait. But if you're talking about variations of within, and I don't, it's a bit more complicated because I don't know which one you're talking about. But yeah, like for example, fair skin is not sexual selection. I don't think. I'd say that it is natural selection, and it comes in Northwest Europe very, it's very prevalent in Northwestern Europe after the introduction of farming, because of the combination of the heavy cloud cover and the diet deficient in vitamin D requires that we absorb more vitamin D from sunlight, and then you have a selection pressure, and that actually makes you more fertile when you're not vitamin D deficient. So obviously the ones who could absorb the more vitamin D are more likely to have more healthy children. So it's like natural selection as well. I mean, it's not sexual selection. I don't think it's sexual selection. No.
Mm-hmm. Although there does seem to be a certain preference for, you know, fair skinned, blonde haired women. Actually, it seems to be quite universal.
That's true. In all cultures, women are preferred to be fair. And pretty much all, like in unrelated, like in Asia, like the women carry, in Southeast Asia, they carry umbrellas around so they don't get suntan, because they're considered, and European women used to try not to go in the sun because they didn't want to get a tan because they were considered unattractive. For some reason now they all spray themselves orange, but it was different in times gone by. But it's the same thing in a way, because it signals prestige, like status. I can go on holiday, or in the old days I don't have to go to work in the field, so I've got fairer skin. But I think that general like idea of fair skin in women being considered attractive, and which emerges in many cultures, comes after you have an agricultural society with clearly demarcated gendered forms of labor, which result in women being typically indoors more, and then you start to see things like fairer skin being associated as a more feminine trait within various cultures in Africa, Asia, and Europe, but also things that, like in the Odyssey, it talks about Penelope having strong fingers, like as a feminine trait, because they were inside all day weaving, so they didn't just have fair skin; they were meant to have very powerful hands from being constantly, we don't associate that with femininity now. You don't say, "Cool, look at her fingers."
No,
look at her strong fingers. But that's, you know, so things change, but it's about gendered forms of labor.
All right. There's one last, well, it's not even a question, it's just a sort of statement of enthusiasm. Jive, I want to go back in time and meet the ancient North Eurasians. I find them fascinating.
Cool. Yeah, me too. That would be fun. But yeah, it won't happen. But yeah, they're really interesting. I'd like to know what they look like. We haven't got a proper skeleton of one yet, so we don't really know. Everyone on internet forums, like Spurgy forums, all very sure they know what the ancient North Eurasians look like, but they disagree with each other, unfortunately, so they argue about it. But there's no skulls, so there's no real way of knowing what they look like. But I suspect they were Europoid, and that I base on the comparison of the phenotypes of the different descendant races who have varying amounts of admixture from them.
Okay, I've just realized there are actually two more questions posted, so we can I'll put them to you and you can answer them quite briefly, ideally, because
crack on with the next one.
There are many people in Woz's chat, mainly Americans, who still believe in the Solutrean hypothesis. Can you give them your thoughts on this theory? By the way, I really like Jive Talks. You should do more of them.
Thank you. Well, if you had liked Jive Talks so much, you'd know that that question has been asked many, many times on Jive Talks. And I've said it already, but thank you. I said it again and again, but I don't believe in the Solutrean hypothesis. I don't think that people who do are stupid. It's like the Khazar theory. It's a good theory, and it was based on good evidence, but I don't think it's true. The Solutrean hypothesis is based on similarity of tools from Iberia and in parts of America, but those similarities don't have to be explained by a common culture. They're not that similar. And the other thing is there were some skulls like the Kennewick man that appeared European, and that was used as evidence to reinforce the theory, except that now we know that Kennewick man, of course, would have certain Europoid features because he's part ancient North Eurasian. And as I said just now, I think ancient North Eurasians were a Europoid population. So I don't think that was, I don't think there was a transatlantic migration personally across this ice sheet that's proposed of seal hunters from Iberia. But what do I know? I'm not an archaeologist. I'm not an expert in that topic, but you asked me, so there you go.
Okay. And now another question. This might be the last one. Yes. Does the Austronesian ancestry found in South Americans come from a Pacific Islander-like population or a Papuan Highlander-like population? And do we have a time frame for when Austronesian DNA entered South America?
Oh, this one's really hard because they've only just found out about the Australasian, not Austronesian. Austronesian is a language family. Australasian or Australoid. The racial anthropological term is Australoid, which they now don't like because it's racist, apparently. But that's the term. Austronesian doesn't mean Australoid, it means Austronesian language, but the an Australoid racial group apparently did live in the Americas, and there's absolutely no way of knowing how they got there. Some people have said that they must have gone the same way the Siberian Americans got there, which is via the ice route. But others say, what are they took a boat? I don't know, it's a bloody long way to go on a boat, and it happened a long, long time ago, like much more than 20,000 years ago. So I don't know whether they were more related to Pacific Islanders. Well, they weren't. The only Pacific Islanders who are Australoid are some who are mixed populations, like Negritos in the Philippines. I don't know if they were more related to Negritos or to Papuans. But I mean, some people even dispute that this Australoid signal that's been discovered in Native Americans in South America is authentic. But I think because they also found, there's two different studies now that have found evidence of it. So it's looking like it's real. And that means maybe it was, you know, the original Earth civilization of the world was Aboriginal Australians flying around the world in UFOs, and they were just, you know, founding everything. Like they're the original creative race, and we should just let them, put them back in charge of everything. At the moment, they're rounding them all up in camps in Australia, from what I understand.
That's something that we'll be talking about again throughout Millennial. But it's a very strange turnaround there.
I just want to specify, about Australia, Aboriginal Australians flying UFOs around, that was a joke. Because I know some people they're not capable of understanding when people are joking. So I just want to say that.
Okay. All right. Well, let's end it there. And this has been going for an hour and a half, actually. It's been quite a longer one. But thank you very much, Survive the Jive, for appearing.
Pleasure as always.
Okay. And I'll be back. I think it's Mark Gullick next. Let me just check. Yes, it's Mark Gullick next from Countercurrents. So I'll be back in about half an hour with him. In the meantime, thank you, Survive the Jive. And
thank you, and good Yule.
Okay, I'll be back soon. See you in a wee while.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.